Okay, we'll get started. Glad to have everyone in class tonight. We continue tonight in looking at the most significant religious movement in Western civilization in the last 600 years. As we talk about the Reformation, it is a fascinating time in history to look at because so many changes are happening. Not just religiously, but socially, economically, culturally, everything is changing. And as the world changes, so does man's view of religion and of Christianity. Last week, we looked at Martin Luther, the giant of the Reformation, and the great effect that he had. He is at the head of the German part of this Reformation, which is primarily in Germany and to the north. Of Europe, a little and northwest, and finally into Scandinavia. All of the Scandinavian countries, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Finland, all become Lutheran. But we have to understand that there are different parts of the Reformation. Even though Luther's 95 theses in his writings spread throughout Europe because of the printing press, it doesn't mean that they are in close communication with one another. And though they get people will get Luther's writings and become familiar with them, the movements they start in their areas remain somewhat independent of what Luther does in Germany. And that's also true because that the different states, the nation states that are rising, in many of these Reformation groups, the state is involved, and you see state churches starting. You really don't have denominationalism yet like we have today, because they did not have the view that all of us are fine, we're all going to heaven. There was a lot of difference within these Reformed movements, as we will see. And it won't be long until the denominational concept comes where they begin to be more accepting of each other. And each church will simply be willing to consider themselves as a part of the Lord's church, one division of it. But let's begin tonight to look into the Reformation in other areas, particularly in Switzerland. Switzerland becomes a hotbed of the Reformation, but not because of Calvin, but because of some other men who arise during this time. And Switzerland is especially suited for the development of the freedom of worship and for independence there, because Switzerland was the most independent of the countries in Europe. It stood separate. It operated itself on a confederacy of provinces, or they called them cantons. A confederacy of about 13 cantons, I believe, in Switzerland. And each canton was somewhat independent, but recognized a confederacy of each other. And there was great freedom there. And it's not unusual that the Reformation movement would take hold there and have great influence during this time. And of course, two great figures arise out of this time. And that is Ulrich Zwingli and John Calvin. They will both have great influence. John Calvin's known to everybody. Zwingli is not necessarily known. Yet Zwingli has a tremendous influence and probably would have had a greater influence if he had not died early in life and had been outlived by John Calvin by 30 years or more. Calvin becomes the great influencer partly because of that. But let's look at these two great men and see, again, the development of Reformation ideas and the effect that these men have and effects that continue to today. Let's first look at Zwingli in our lesson sheets. Like most of these reformers, these great reformers, leaders in the Reformation, he starts as a Catholic priest. Nearly all of these men, like Luther and others, Calvin and others start as ministers or priests within Catholicism. And the thing that changes everything for every one of these men, you'll see it in common with them, is they get access to copies of the scripture that they can read for their own. And when they begin to study the Bible on their own, their mindset changes completely about how one is related to Christ and what the church should be. And this is what happens with Zwingli. As he begins his personal study of the scriptures, he begins to oppose many of the Catholic abuses, like indulgences. He comes out against them and against the corruption that he's seeing, the things the priests are doing that are completely foreign to what he reads in the Bible. And this a rage in him by what he's seeing increases, and his opposition increases during this time. His knowledge of the scriptures, interestingly, relates back to learning the Greek text itself. The Greek text of Erasmus that had been produced about this time becomes the most influential text in the Reformation because it is an excellent translation, an excellent text of the New Testament in the Greek language. I've mentioned before that the earlier reformers, you go back to Wycliffe and back into that time, they didn't have Greek texts. They only had copies of the Latin Vulgate, which Jerome had translated back in the 4th century. And the Latin was many times not an accurate translation. So when these men get their hands on Greek texts, they begin to really see, as they translate it for themselves, the difference between what the original text was saying and what the Latin Vulgate said. And they also were better able to make application as a result of that. Zwingli's desire for this is seen in the fact that he could not get his own copy of Erasmus' Greek text. And so he borrowed one, and he made a handwritten copy of all of Paul's letters. And once he'd done that, he then memorized it in the Greek. Now, this is his commitment to learning the New Testament. And it's not uncommon that this is what happened in the Reformers. They wanted to know what the Bible said. His conversion comes about as a result of a couple of things. So one is exposure to Luther's writings. But it's also during a time when the Black Plague comes through Switzerland in that area in 1519. You got to think how sobering that is. Eventually, 1 in 3 people in Europe die from the bubonic plague. And so when you see so many people dying around you, it certainly sobers you up. And he's reading Luther's writings at this time. He's getting access to the scriptures, and this changes his view completely. This is where he begins to seriously question the Catholic Church and what it's doing, and begins to speak out. It's interesting that he married in 1522, which of course went against Catholic teaching altogether. But he did it secretly to begin with. I guess he had to work up his courage about letting everybody know or worried about what the Catholic Church would do. Well, it's not announced public, didn't have a public ceremony until 2 years later, but that's a major step for a priest to become married. And so he's well on his way to the break with Catholicism during this time. His view of biblical authority differed from Luther's. He actually was stricter in his view of biblical authority. He believed that nothing should be practiced that could not be expressly or specifically proved from scriptures. You had to be able to go to scripture and say, here's the authority for it. Luther, on the other hand, recognized the authority of scriptures, but in matters that were religious matters, he believed that anything that was not specifically prohibited by scriptures would still be acceptable. It will be Luther's view that really carries the day in the Reformation movement. But you can see how Zwingli would be much stricter and certainly fits where we stand today and our beliefs, that you've got to be able to give book, chapter, and verse for what you believe and teach. You can't just say, well, the Bible doesn't say not to do it. You have to be able to get that positive affirmation from Scripture. Well, that's where Zwingli was. And in that way, he was considered somewhat more radical on his view of biblical authority. His views spread enough through several cantons there that strongly Catholic cantons become concerned about its influence. And they actually unite to fight against the Reformation cantons that are forming during this time. It's interesting to see that they would actually go into military conflict over these matters. But we have to understand that these movements and these churches, Reformation churches that are forming, were forming with approval of government officials. Actually, the officials of a canton, the government officials, would actually vote and decide which was going to be accepted in their canton. Was it going to be Reformation or was it going to be Catholicism? And Zwingli was able to persuade some of the cantons to become Reformed churches by going and debating it publicly before the church officials, and then the church officials would vote. Well, the result is the state governments or these canton governments have a direct link and a say. They have a stake in the church. And this is what they've decided. And when it's being challenged from the outside, they're going to defend it. The Catholic cantons were the same way. And so it becomes a military conflict where they fight each other. And it's during one of these battles, Zwingli believed in the military and in defense by military. But he served, he went out and served in these battles as a chaplain. And regrettably, in one of these battles, he was killed. So as I said, he died much earlier than Calvin did. But he had a great influence during that time, and his views had a great influence. Zwingli is a very important figure in Reformation history. Calvin is the one that is most known, but Zwingli is also well known during this time. Any questions or thoughts about Zwingli or anything we've covered so far? Anyone have anything? Okay. We're in the early to mid 1500s is where we're going during this time. And so we're well into the Renaissance. You have to keep thinking about how thinking is being influenced by Renaissance views and the more independent ideas that are allowed and the independent thinking that is causing people to not be as dependent in their education and thinking from the Catholic Church as it had been before. So all this is having an effect. Well, John Calvin is born in 1509. And this is a man whose teachings, whose theology is at the foundation of the theology of all major denominations that come out of the Reformation. And its influence continues strongly to today in almost all of the mainline churches. You will see his influence in the theology. So he becomes this major figure and influence in the Reformation movement. He not only popularizes the theology that has come to be called Calvinism, but he also is influential in believing in the independence of churches and develops what comes to be called the Presbyterian form of government. That is, churches overseen by their own elders or presbytery. Remember, presbyteros is one of the six terms in the New Testament that refers to the office of elder or overseer. So he believed in that. The Presbyterian Church today still reflects that. He believed in that, but the total independence was not completely there. Local churches were formed into presbyteries, and then the presbyteries had representatives or delegates that were elected to go to a major synod for all the churches. But they were elected by the churches, and therefore they saw it as a representative, more a democratic kind of rule than certainly Catholicism had during that time. But that idea of a Presbyterian government is really something that is championed by Calvin, and he's seen in many churches today. One of the significant differences between Luther and Zwingli were some differences over the Calvinistic ideas of original sin and unconditional election and those kinds of things. Zwingli is a little more liberal than Calvin is on these things. Zwingli tried very much to avoid the idea that God pre-chose those who would be lost and predetermined those who would be lost in addition to those that would be saved. But Calvin's belief in the sovereignty of God was so strong that he believed that God had to predetermine everything. So he predetermined each individual that would be lost or saved. Zwingli wanted to say he could accept that God had predetermined some to salvation, but he was not going to say that God caused a man to be lost. So there is that and some other differences in his view between these two. Calvin spends almost all his life, all of his adult life, in Geneva, in Switzerland. And he becomes the main figure in Geneva. He was a towering figure there, and his influence is felt in every way during that time. But he's actually French. I don't think most people know Calvin was French. And his father was an aristocrat. He was able to get an excellent education, attended the University of Paris for a while, gets a law degree at another school. He was well educated. But he becomes converted to Reformation theology that he had been exposed to while he was in college. His most influential writings are the Institutes of Religion, which are a series of writings contained in about four books, and where he lays out the theology of Calvinism. These books are still studied today widely and continue to be the basis of the Calvinist ideas that are influential in so many churches. He wrote commentaries in almost all the books in the New Testament. I told him the lesson that he didn't write commentaries on 2nd, 3rd John and Revelation. And he said the reason he didn't was he didn't understand them. I think he didn't understand why he thought they would be in scripture, 2nd, 3rd John. He saw his personal letters, I think. But his commentaries, his Institutes of Religion, some other books that he wrote, widely disseminated, had tremendous influence upon the Reformation and upon that theology during that time. He in Geneva, is able to influence the government, the form of government in that canton and in Geneva. It's set up into four different parts. One of he had established was called the consistory. The consistory dealt, or was made up of church officials, and it dealt with religious matters, matters of morality and doctrine. Calvin was very strict about people following the doctrines of the Reformation that he taught. And like, just like the Catholic Church, if you didn't follow what he believed, you were a heretic. And he was able to establish this part of the government that would follow strictly the theology that that canton had accepted, and also would carry out judgments concerning immorality, things such as that. Punishment was severe. Not only were people excommunicated, they were executed. And lots of people were executed in Geneva during Calvin's time there for being heretics. I think I listed a number in here between 1542 and 1546. 58 people were executed in Geneva. 76 were exiled for their beliefs or for their wayward lives. And that continued into the years following that. So this is how strict Calvin was. Calvin was not a government official, but don't make any mistake, he was in control. And he ruled Geneva with an iron hand. And if a man he thought was a heretic, he would have him brought before the consistory, convicted, and disciplined. So in this way, and you see this a lot in these Reformed churches, they were just as strict about people adhering to the doctrine or carrying out discipline about it as the Catholic Church had. I mean, the Catholic Church had been doing this for, you know, 1,000 years, executing heretics and burning them at the stake and all those kinds of things. And it's interesting that some of these Reformation movements do the same thing. When they become get control of an area, those who teach different doctrines, if someone defends Catholicism, they'll be tried and disciplined, exiled, or something like that. This is going on during that time, and a couple of historians I read try to justify this. I can tell they're very much Reformation men, but try to justify this, saying, well, this is just the way it was in those times. The Catholic Church had done that, and so and so. No, it's not what the scriptures taught. If they're wanting to adhere to the scriptures, they certainly should be executing men that they believed as false teachers. That were not done certainly in New Testament times. But Calvin's reach of influence in his theology does become very great. It goes into Western Europe. It will go into eventually into the Anglican Church and the British Isles. And of course, churches that come out of that area and go into the Americas are greatly influenced by Calvin. He will have the greatest influence on Reformation churches of any single individual. Luther started it, but Luther's theology does not have the following and the effect that Calvin's theology does. So it is Calvin's theology that carries the day in Reformation churches and continues to this day. Okay, any thoughts or questions, comments about Calvin before we go on?
Hey, Steve, it's Eric.
Yeah.
Any thoughts as to why Calvin's theology took off more so than Luther's? Was there an appetite for that more than, man, that may be a poor choice of words, but any insight?
Well, I think part of it, from what I read, is that Calvin was just a better theologian than Luther was. Luther was, in many ways, I think I mentioned here, one historian said that Luther was more the prophet of the movement. In other words, he was the man like Isaiah or Jeremiah who stood out front and proclaimed what needed to be proclaimed without fear and proclaimed the Reformation idea. But it's Calvin who is the organizer, who puts the theology together in a logical form and a form to be argued and to be defended. And so the theology that is the basis of the movement really comes from Calvin instead of Luther. So when I say one is more influential than the other, I mean it, I guess, in terms of theology. Luther stands as the giant who started the movement and a tremendous influence. But Luther's view of the church was that it was basically a state church, and he wanted the state involved in the church. He invited it in to be a part of it. Calvin's theology, although he denies state control, still involves the government in it, but he will proclaim the idea of separation of church and state. But it's the theology of Calvin then that, because I think it's so well organized, so well argued, that causes it to be the most influential. Do you have any thoughts on it, Eric? Okay.
No, I tend to agree with that. Luther seems to have been, and correct me if I'm wrong, more in confrontation with Catholicism initially, but by the time Calvin comes, do you see that kind of attack on what Calvin was doing or proclaiming in his theology to the same degree that was happening with Luther initially?
I think it's a good observation, and I think the reason for that is because Calvin was in Switzerland, and Luther was in Germany. In Switzerland, the sway of Catholicism would not be as, or the power of Catholicism would not be as strong because of the belief of the more independent Switzerland. That is, giving more freedom, and Catholicism did not have as strong an influence there. In Germany, it did. It ruled in Germany still when Luther came along. And so I think when Calvin comes along, which is later than Luther, that there is more opportunity there for Calvin to influence and not have to deal as directly with opposition from the Catholic Church. But yeah, I think you're right about that. I do. Other ideas or thoughts? Okay. Well, I want to look at a third movement during this time that I look at a little differently from the way most mainline historians look at it. I'm not saying that there are other historians that don't. There are other historians who look at it this way. But a third influential movement during this time is the Anabaptist movement. The Anabaptist movement is pictured by most historians as coming out of Ulrich Zwingli's Reformation movement. There's no doubt of close association with it, and that some men who originally are influenced by Zwingli become Anabaptists, but it is a separate movement that really rises to prominence during this time. Many of those that were called Anabaptists were part of movements that preceded the Reformation, that had been around. We talked in an earlier lesson when I talked about the evidence of New Testament Christians through the Middle Ages. We talked about the Waldensians. And the Waldensian movement, in many ways, there were groups in that are very similar to the Anabaptists. And you can establish ties between the two, but their beliefs on church autonomy and local rule and elders and baptism of believers by immersion and all these kinds of things. You find that in the Waldensians, and you'll find it in the Anabaptist groups also. So when you look at the Anabaptist group, I don't see it as beginning during the Reformation. It simply rises to prominence because it is now a time where such separatist or independent groups that were out of the mainstream and had been persecuted now have the freedom to advance what they believe, or at least more freedom than they had. And their ideas to some extent, fall in with many of the ideas of the Reformation. So they come to prominence. They will eventually also be persecuted. But nonetheless, the Anabaptists come on the scene during this time. And you will find among them groups that are very close to New Testament Christianity. And some of them that I think could even be identified as New Testament Christians. Their doctrines would indicate that. John Kennedy, in his book, The Torch of the Testimony, says that the group consisted of those who had never really been associated with Catholic churches or Reformed churches. And I believe that's true. So it is a powerful third religious force that comes to the foreground during this time. Religious historians like to give Conrad Grebel the credit for starting the Anabaptist movement. He was in Germany in the late 1480 to 1528. His basic beliefs were separation of church and state, the final authority of the scriptures, the baptism of believers. His beliefs, for which he felt very strongly, and his other views that differed from Calvinistic theology, ended up in him being opposed and his followers being persecuted by both Lutherans and Catholics. And so he is going to be opposed by both groups. He eventually has to flee to Moravia, to the east. But the influence of Catholicism is still strong, and eventually he is arrested, and the emperor orders that he be burned at the stake, and he was. And his wife was taken and thrown off a bridge into a river to drown. The Catholic authorities did that. So the Anabaptist movement very quickly becomes opposed, and it is in many ways because it is more conservative than these other movements and because it is uncompromising in its belief in things such as baptism of adult believers, rejection of infant baptism, rejection of original sin, belief in the independence of local churches, free from hierarchical authority of any kind. These things cause them to eventually be persecuted and exiled. And we'll see that they spread all over the place as a result of this. The term Anabaptist is one that their enemies gave them. As you'll usually find during this time, the Catholic Church, or as we'll see, some Reformed churches will give their opposition nicknames that they think are unfavorable to them. Anabaptist basically means to be baptized again. And the reason they used that term was because these groups required those who've been baptized as infants to be baptized again in order to be acceptable. They had to be baptized as adults, as believers. So they got this nickname, and the fact that they would reject infant baptism and such things certainly caused them to be opposed by many during this time. Some interesting groups come out of this. Conservative groups and also some radical groups come out of it. There are just a lot of different groups that come out of it. And you simply can't name Anabaptists and say, here's what Anabaptists believes, because there were widely varied groups within it. Groups such as the Amish, the Mennonites, the Hutterites, which are all very similar groups in their beliefs and teachings, come out of the Anabaptist movement. We know these groups mainly because they're kind of like groups that have been frozen in time. They, at certain point in history, decided to reject all innovation and worldly trappings they saw around them, and just kind of froze in time at that point. And so many of these are groups that still dressed in clothes from 150, 200 years ago, do not use cars, electricity, several things like that. When I grew up in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, there was a Mennonite group, a community just out of town. And I visited in it on occasion, went with my father, who was a preacher, would go out and visit the leader of the group and have some biblical discussions with him. Of course, they had a lot in common with us. But I remember in some of those discussions, them discussing baptism, because that group did not baptize by immersion. And so Dad looked it up, and in a discussion with him, looked up the German word for baptism and went out and discussing it with him, and the man trying to defend it had to be immersion. Dad said, well, you know, the German word for baptism means immersion. And the guy wasn't even sure, but his son was there. And his son looked at his father and said, he's right, Dad. He said, that's correct. But anyway, there were some interesting discussions, and it was a very conservative group. They dressed in the old clothes. They used horse and buggies. They didn't have electricity in their homes. They would use motors, gasoline motors that were stationary. They wouldn't use a tractor or something like that. They used stationary threshing machines in their fields that they would carry out there on a wagon pulled by a horse and use it that way. We went into the leather shop that one of the men had there, and he had a gasoline engine that ran a shaft that leather belts ran off to run his different pieces of machinery. So they're interesting groups, and they're very moral, upright, spiritually minded people. And these are the kind of groups that did come out of the Anabaptist movement. They were, to the most part, all of them wanting nothing to do with the worldliness and the immorality and that lifestyle at all. They sought a pure, more humbler type of lifestyle. And so you will see these kind of groups come out of it. But they're not the only groups to come out of it. There are many other groups identified with the Anabaptists that practice so many elements of New Testament Christianity. We're going to talk about their legacy in the British Isles in the next lesson, where we're really going to get into what we will see as the roots of the Restoration Movement. There are these groups, and there are groups in Europe during this time also that I say you could identify as New Testament Christians. We're going to look at some things in Keith Sissman's book called Traces of the Kingdom, and also one other book that historically shows groups that could be identified as New Testament churches during the very times in which we're looking at and lead into the Restoration Movement. We'll look at that also. But the Anabaptist movement is an independent movement from Luther's Reformation and from the Swiss Reformation. It is independent of that. The Reformation movement in England, as we'll say, really started politically with Henry VIII. But there are influences coming from Europe onto the continent that are outside of the Church of England during that time. So we've looked at three groups. We've looked at Zwingli's Reformation, we've looked at Calvin's Reformation, and we've looked at what came to be called as the Anabaptist movement. All of these have tremendous influence in Europe during this time. And as I say, the group that we're going to look at for the most are those who come out of the Anabaptist movement for the most part. Because that's where, if you want to call it this, we can trace our heritage to a great extent through that. Okay, any questions or comments?
I guess it seems to me, just in a very broad sense, especially when we talk about people like Luther and Calvin, that there's this idea of maybe reactionary theology, that, you know, they see all the corruption, they see all the problems within the Catholic Church, and so they say, well, this must not be it. And so if it's not this, then what could it be? Rather than pursuing the objective truth of the scriptures. And that seems to be what the Anabaptists were trying to do more of, though they had a lot of reactionary theology, and that they saw all the worldliness that was caught up. And it seems, just as a holistic principle, that when we try to not be like someone else, that's not really enough. That just not being sinful isn't sufficient. What we need to do is to seek truth for truth's sake, to say that, to maybe admit that other people have pieces of it. And so we don't call each other like, oh, well, that's very Baptist thinking of you. You know, that's things that I've heard in the churches that I've grown up in. It's like, oh, you're kind of looking like a Baptist over there when you say stuff like that. Well, I think that's not really useful when we discuss systems of theology, because we should just look at the objective.
Yeah. Who is this?
This is Caleb.
Who is it?
Caleb Hurd.
Oh, okay. All right. There is a great lesson to learn in this. And it, actually, I mean, you see it in all the reformers to some extent, is when the pendulum is swung so far as it has in Catholicism and they react to it, they swing all the other way. When Luther saw such emphasis upon works and keeping the sacraments and all of that, his reaction was to go all the way to the other extreme and say, no works, nothing at all. And it's clear that that's a reactionary thing that he responded to, because the works and the way it was presented in Catholicism and dependent upon the church to make it possible for you to perform the works, that view, that idea, as Luther observed it, he found it repugnant, and so he removes works completely, as I said. And all these men, you see that, and in the Anabaptist movement, you see it in terms of, like the Amish or the Mennonites, they reject society as a whole and become, some of them, really communal groups. You do see that happening. Our lesson for us is that when we see groups practicing error, even on fundamental things like not believing in the necessity of baptism or things like that, when we see that, we do have to be willing to stand up for what the truth says, but make sure that what we teach is based upon what the scriptures say and is not just reactionary to what somebody's doing that we don't like. It is a tendency for us to, if we see a group that clearly is practicing false doctrine, to identify everything they do with false doctrine. And so we won't practice it because that group practices it. If that's the way we look at things, and like you say, you're saying, well, that sounds a little denominational there. Well, just because a denomination may practice it doesn't mean it's wrong. I mean, if that was true, we wouldn't be able to use songbooks or pews or church buildings or anything like that, because they all use those. You have to be careful. As you say, you need to be able to defend it from the truth and make sure that's the basis, and not judge everything another group does wrong. But do not be afraid to oppose what truly is wrong, and make sure that what we follow is not just reactionary, but is biblical in what we do. So, yeah, I think that's a good observation to make and a great lesson for us to learn.
I think you summed it up better than I could. I appreciate those comments, Steve.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, any other thoughts or questions? Okay, that's going to be it. Okay, well, then on Monday, we're going to really began to get into what to me is some of the most interesting part of this whole section. We're going to begin to hone in on the part of the Western religious movement from which we can trace our heritage. And we'll begin that really in the British Isles. That's where we'll do this. We begin to look at that and then trace that down to our times. My intention is to bring this all the way down to the 21st century and looking at what is happening in the Lord's Church. We want to do that.
Hey, Steve, I do have a question.
Yeah.
What were Calvin's views on the organization of the church?
Okay.
If you told us about that and I missed it, I apologize.
Okay. Well, he developed the Presbyterian idea, as it's called, the idea of a presbytery. Presbyterian, presbyteros, is one of the words applied to elders, and that's where he's getting it. He believed in the oversight of local churches by elders, and that they had an independence in local autonomy. They believed that. But he still was in favor of churches being related through what he named presbyteries, that is, a group of churches would make up a presbytery, and they would have representatives that would meet with one another, and then presbyteries would send representatives, elected representatives, to a head synod, as they called it. They would meet and discuss matters and discuss doctrine. Eventually came to where, you know, what the synod decided was what you had to believe. That's where that comes from. But he believed in the independence of the local church. And I would compare it to, you know, like what you see in the Southern Baptist organization. They'll tell you every local church is independent and autonomous, yet they still send elected officials to a convention where they vote on things for the church, and then if you're going to be in the convention, this is what you're going to have to follow. It's basically a very similar idea as far as viewpoint from that. So that's where Calvin was on that. Of course, that was repugnant to the Catholic Church.
Okay.
Yes.
I said thank you.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, we're out of time here. We ought to wrap it up. I appreciate everybody being here tonight. I'm really looking forward to where we go in the studies next, and I hope you'll find it interesting too. All right. Thanks for being here tonight.